It's the election fraud edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, anti-GMO protests, anti-fluoridation rot, anti-vaxxers expelled, and anti-democracy fraud. Let's begin episode 212.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ethan, remember last week's show I mentioned that the election isn't quite over?
I actually recall that, yes.
Yeah, well, it seems like that those people who are really into for political horse races, the race is still on. It was just tweeted recently that NDP candidate Selena Robertson has actually won her Coquitlam-Millardville riding by a total of 35 votes. She's actually going into this behind 150, but after they tallied the absentee votes and that sort of thing, she actually won. So it looks like that could be quite interesting still to come.
Excellent. Well, we'll have to keep our eyes peeled on the election front.
Well, and you know, speaking of fronts, Hitler had a front. It was a popular front, too. No, Volkswagen. Was it something good that Hitler did? Volkswagen, as most of us probably know, actually stands for the people's car. But did you know that it turned 75 last week?
I did not know that.
Did you also know that it was the brainchild of one Mr. Adolf Hitler?
I had heard that, actually.
It seems that people wanted an affordable car in Germany, but the German car industry really only wanted to produce for the wealthy. Only like 2% of people had a car in Germany at that time. Adolf Hitler got involved and demanded that the production of a basic vehicle be built that was capable of transporting two adults and three children up to 100 kilometers an hour. He wanted the German citizens to have the same access to cars as Americans. And this would be competing with the Model T Ford sort of thing. The people's car would be available to citizens of the Third Reich through a savings scheme at a price of 990 Reichmark, which was about $396 in 1930 dollars in the States. The price was about the same price as a small motorcycle at the time. It should be noted that the average income for a person about then was $12 a week. So in a month, you made about as much as we spend on a shirt or something. But they had bigger dollars back then. When the private sector couldn't actually supply the affordable car that Hitler wanted, he chose to sponsor an all-new state-owned factory. Volkswagen was founded in 1937 by the Nazi trade union, the German Labor Front. Hitler introduced a savings scheme which put the car in reach of every German with a plan that allowed people to put $2 a week away for about 4 years, so it wasn't quick, but you put a little money away and then you got your car. Hundreds of thousands of people took advantage of this program and many got cars. However, sadly, can you feel sorry for Nazis? Well, anyway, unfortunately for the Germans, when the Russians took over, they seized the accounts that were worth millions of dollars. Mm. Do you have a Volkswagen?
I do not have a Volkswagen, actually. We were talking earlier about, I guess, our favorite wartime products.
Actually, I think it was more German products.
Yeah, but anyway, I was mentioning how I actually really like BMWs. I don't know why, I just do. And I, of course, divorced myself from their association with the Nazi war machine.
I'm more of a Porsche person, but I have nothing to do with the camps, not me, you know. Which is why I can honestly say I've never bought a Porsche because of my high moral standards.
Yeah, that's exactly why you haven't bought one. Well, I mean, it's not like, I guess if you were a radical North Americanist, you could go with Ford.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work, does it? No,
it doesn't.
Speaking of things that aren't working, we talked recently about a push to stop fluoridation of tap water in Portland during a segment. And during that segment, we also revised our discussion about how Calgary in late 2011 had ended fluoridation in its water. Well, we can say that it seems that fluoridation is beneficial and maybe should have been kept in the water. It seems that pediatric dentists in Calgary are reporting noticeable increase in patient flow and the number and severity of cavities in its general population since the city council decided to save $750,000 and stop fluoridation. Dr. Sarah Holland stated that, quote, kids are coming into our office with bigger cavities than historically has been seen before. They are growing at a faster rate than they did a year ago. Now, these are dentists, and you'd think they kind of actually be happy with Calgary's move. I mean, in a monetary sense, they're making more money and they've got more clientele. CBC reported that 30% of children 5 and under have rampant tooth decay in their mouth. Now, of course, this is just anecdotal evidence. I tried to find out if anyone has yet done a sort of scientific study on the effects. But science does start with anecdotes as much as we tend to condemn them, but then it progresses on with actually real study and it follows the evidence. I did, however, in the course of my research, come across some comparisons to cities in Ontario where fluoridation continues and Quebec where it has stopped. These numbers showed that kids 6 to 12 in Quebec had a 4% higher rate of cavities. And when you went to the 13 to 17 age group, it was over 15%. This correlates with the fact that teenagers are much more likely to skip the brush, while youngins are harassed more by the parents and much more likely to brush. Remember, the whole point of fluoridation is to ensure that everyone is protected regardless of their hygiene habits. That said, when Calgary actually originally voted to stop fluoridation, the money saved was to be spent on an anti-cavity program for children in need who are living below in poverty. The council did grant the money in 2012 to community groups, but none of that actually ever got spent on a dental hygiene program. And this was a one-time grant, so really, Calgary just sort of gave up on healthcare for the poor.
Well, it's kind of silly that they would expect community centers and healthcare providers focusing on underprivileged children to develop anti-cavity measures. I mean, I think they're probably more concerned with like nutrition and shelter. You know, it's just kind of ludicrous that they're going to be like, okay, let's start an anti-cavity program and we'll go around to all the homeless shelters and remind the kids to brush their teeth. With what? Like,
yeah, no, exactly. I mean, if you don't think about it, I mean, it does cost money to have toothpaste. It does cost money to have toothbrushes. And in a lot of poor families, you're debating whether you're going to pay the rent, the electricity bill, or feed your kids. Toothbrushes fall by the wayside.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I also think it was quite disingenuous that, you know, they were supposed to put this money into the campaign, and it was just a one-time bit in the first place. You know, if they had spent this annually, then you could say, okay, well, you're trying at least to promote it, even if it's misdirected. And it's not like they didn't know this was coming. I mean, when the original presentations were made about this particular effect, they seemed to give weight to the people who said, my body is my own protection, and I don't want to be, quote-unquote, poisoned by fluoridation, versus the public health good that is derived from this. You know, it ties into so many of the anti-things we talk about.
Well, I mean, talking about the precautionary principle and this notion of my fear overrules science segues nicely into our next anti-segment. And this is made news headlines around North America. Vancouver was host to a big protest over GMO foods, and particularly Monsanto, the sort of boogeyman of big corporations.
It is the Walmart of the agricultural food area.
Yeah, it's the Microsoft of technology.
It is the Apple of... Yeah, okay, let's...
No, we can keep doing that all day. Anyway, so this was part of a sort of, a global protest where they had roughly about 57 countries, I believe, participated and about 436 cities. So this was a pretty well-coordinated effort, basically saying, we're here, we don't want to deal with GMO foods, and we don't care about the science. We're concerned that, you know, we're being poisoned by big corporations. Now, we've actually sort of talked about this a couple times on the show, so I don't really want to go over what we've already said. So I wanted to talk about an article that I read on NPR about sort of the top five myths associated with GMO foods. And actually, we're only going to really talk about two because we don't have a lot of time. But it's a good article. I suggest you check it out. So the question we have here is, you know, why are people afraid of GMO foods when you think that with a population of about, you know, 7 billion, we kind of need everything we have to feed all these people. We need crops that are going to last a long time, are going to have high yields, and are resistant to pesticides and pests and bugs and that kind of thing.
The whole host of things that can attack. I mean, right now with climate change, that's another big area where they're trying to do this sort of things.
Exactly. And I mean, after all, we have been genetically modifying our food since, well, ever, because that's what we do. We cross breed, we look for plants that last longer, and we select them and grow them. And so, yeah, we've been doing this for a really long time. But anyway, getting onto these myths. So this article written by Dan Charles, and one of the first ones that I think comes up often is that the seeds from GMOs are sterile. And the answer to this is actually, no, they're not sterile. They will grow like any other seed. Some GMO crops have what's called a terminator gene. And this is done for, I guess, different reasons, to protect patents, to control where they grow. I mean, we have things like invasive species. Some companies, Monsanto included, has a patent on terminator genes. They've promised not to use it. I'm sure they might break their word, but it's not like every GMO apple you buy at the grocery store has a terminator gene, and if it goes off, your head will explode or something. You know, we're allowing tiny grains of truth here to sort of sprout into webs of conspiracy. And I think it's important to keep in mind just what we're eating and sort of what's on the laboratory counter in some gene splicing place that's never really going to make it to our dinner plate.
Yeah, no, lots of times too. I mean, there's sort of a cost-benefit analysis, right? So if you have this terminator gene technology, sometimes there's a price to be paid for it. So you may get less yield, or it may be harder to handle or something like that. And I think a lot of that plays into sort of the calculation. So on the one hand, and actually the big issue with the sort of terminator gene idea is they say, well, this forces farmers to buy their seed from Monsanto, that they're not allowed to keep their own seed, as if this was 1840 when people did that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I was doing a little bit of research before the show on this, and it was a study mainly about corn, but it was showing that actually from the 1920s, people were less and less doing this. And actually by the 1970s, over 90% of that particular crop, people bought their seed. Right now, it's much easier for farmers to sell off all their grain, buy the new seed. And part of the reason why is the genetic modification that we've been talking about. I mean, there is a real sense of that in the idea of hybridation, that when you plant a seed from a seed, like, so you naturally pollinate it, right? It washes out the hybridization. So the thing that you wanted from the seed, you know, the big growth, the resistance to whatever, that was naturally occurring through selective breeding, eventually gets watered down if you keep your own seed. It sort of defeats the whole purpose of being in there in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
So farmers are already buying all of their seed from these groups. There's no need for Monsanto to do this terminator gene. It doesn't need to.
Yeah, exactly. And Monsanto is sort of like the boogeyman of this whole web of conspiracies. It's just everything they do has some icky hands on it. And again, not to defend big corporations, because we don't really try to do that very often.
I just, on the record, I do hate Monsanto, not because of their practices of genetically modifying food, but I mean, they are a monopoly. They're part of the oligarchy. They do put in special laws just for them. It's a legal thing.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many great reasons to hate this company. This just really isn't one of them.
Exactly. So the other sort of long-standing myth is that Monsanto will sue you if you grow their patent GMOs, or if traces of those GMOs like enter your fields through the wind or something like that. And this myth is so prevalent, but it's not true. In fact, Monsanto has never sued anyone for trace amounts of seeds being blown over in the wind. There have been real cases where Monsanto sued farmers for actually stealing their crops, you know, like taking them and planting them.
Well, no, actually, there is a famous case in Saskatchewan, which when I first heard it, I was like, oh, this is like big corporations were real evil for doing this, right? Again, I wasn't against the modification.
Right, yeah.
But this was a horrible thing because apparently the original story was a Saskatchewan farmer, his corn was naturally pollinated by the Monsanto genetically modified one, and that it turned up in his crop, and he didn't try to do it. It's nothing to do with him. This was just nature at work. Well, apparently what he was doing was that when his seed came up, he would take Roundup and go around the edges of his field, where his neighbors who were using this, to kill off all of his crops, and only those that had cross-pollinated with the Monsanto. Then he took these seeds, and this is what he was using to pollinate. So, granted, maybe a bit of a gray area. They were his seeds, so to speak. But he definitely knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty sneaky of him. And what's interesting is I found out that in 2011, a group of farmers actually sued Monsanto, saying that GMOs might contaminate their crops, and then Monsanto might sue them for patent infringement. So they were suing Monsanto for something that Monsanto hasn't even done yet. And I can just sort of picture the judge in this case going, wait, what?
Yes.
And so basically they said, come up with evidence or a case where this has happened, and they couldn't. So the judge threw out the case. Now, I mean, I'm sure that if Monsanto wanted to, they could get around legal things. They're a big company. But again, as Don said, let's hate them for the things that they do and not things they don't do.
Well, and like one of the big things is, what is it called? What's the Monsanto? It's Monsanto Atman. Monsanto. Exclusion Act or something. It was just passed recently. Mm. And it was actually a rider put into one of the bills that says that, you know, if they want to grow a GMO crop, that even if the judge says you can't do it, they can still do it. Now, again, irrespective of that, you should be upset that they can get a law put into, like, it was a budget bill or something that had nothing to do with whatever they're doing. But I think another thing, too, that often comes up these days is that, you know, everyone says, well, you know, we need to know what's in there because everything is genetically modified in the sense of they're putting genes in from other animals that wouldn't get together in nature. And I was thinking about that. And it strikes me as weird. So this gene that was in a pig, and let's pretend we put it into a sheep because we wanted to make pig sheep, which is actually something they want to do because they want the wool from the sheep and the, right?
Right, right.
So either you're implying that pigs are poisonous or sheep are toxic, you know, because, I mean, I can't. There's no real combination of anything that pigs or sheep do. I mean, if you're crossing a bee with a crow, okay, maybe the crow would grow a stinger and that might cause some issues.
Yeah, or like a shark with an eagle or something.
Right. And the other thing, too, that's important to remember is that nature has a really good way of preventing, how do we put this, monsters from being created. I mean, the vast majority of conceptions, right, where, you know, sperm and egg meet and life is grown, are destroyed because the genetic combination in there is something that says, no, I don't think this is going to be viable, and it's sort of a self-terminating process. So even if we artificially put some genes into something that causes it to do X, Y, or Z, really there's a fail-safe built into it so far, where nature will just say, no, that is an abomination. It shouldn't live for one reason or another. And the idea that there are genetic crops everywhere is another fallacy. Okay, they're in some industries like corn, canola, yes, the vast majority of them. But things like tomatoes, which is interesting because there was a genetically modified tomato that they brought out that they thought would last longer, would be easier to ship. And it turns out that A, nobody wanted it because it's very tasteless. And B, there were some other costs involved in creating it. So they actually took it off the market. Everyone's worried about genetically modified salmon. And again, might be something to worry, but right now there is no such thing as genetically modified salmon on the market.
Yeah.
You know, wheat, there is no genetically modified wheat, unless, again, you refer back to hybridization. And there, yeah, there's tons of things we do. And if you really, really want to get paranoid about stuff, people may or may not be aware, but bacteria have the ability to transfer DNA amongst species.
Really?
Yes. It's not everyone, but there are species of bacteria that have the capability of sort of, you know, they infected one host that happens to be a pig, and then they infect a sheep, and part of their ability to try and adapt and co-op with everything is they do bits of gene swiping. And so you get these natural genetic modifications happening in nature, which is
well, nature's
weird.
Very judgmental about those sort of things, as you mentioned. There's one thing that I wanted to just quickly point out, and I saw this in sort of the local write-ups in the paper, and they sort of quoted the organizers and whatnot, claiming that there are serious health conditions, there are harms to the environment. But they never said what these harms or health consequences were. It was just sort of they parroted the organizers, and they didn't add anything to this. And I just find that very disturbing, you know? Like, I think they have a responsibility to say, well, what? What are these concerns?
Well, you know, because then they're just going to bring out the, you know, Phil, who lives down the street, he gets headaches whenever he comes near a salad, right?
Yeah.
So, obviously, it's a genetically modified alfalfa in the salad that's causing that.
Yeah, the tomatoes in the salad are bombarding him with radiation or something. Well, okay, that's our rant on anti-GMOs. Let's go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back after this.
Gee, your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part four of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Men in the Morning.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
My name is Natasha. I am a robot now. I am playing with my breast again. Nothing to do, nothing to do. Sometimes I listen to Misery Hour with Hans Close Wednesday at 11 before midnight. I don't think I like it.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So continuing our trend of anti-coverage.
Yes, this time we're going to be expelling the anti-vaxxers.
Hooray!
We've talked many times in the show about how the anti-vax movement is a detriment to health and safety in our society. I mean, they kill kids. Well, it seems that they are being taken more seriously by public officials, and in a good way. Early this month, Ottawa public health officials told parents that if their kids were not vaccinated, they would be expelled from school. So, as of May 5th, over 600 Ottawa area students were asked not to return to class. It should be seen that the public officials are taking the health risk posed by unvaccinated people seriously, and this seems to be a tiny step towards taking that responsibility in hand. Eric LeClaire, spokesperson for the agency, said that a lot of mistruths are out there. We have to fight that reality and try to show that vaccination, next to clean water and sanitation, is the most powerful public health tool that exists on the planet. The actual regulation that allows officials to tell kids to stay home has been on the books since 1980. However, only recently, with the return of preventable epidemics, the government officials have sort of shifted from the, quote, if we ignore it, it will go away, and then they had the, we'll pelt it with pamphlets, and then it'll go away, and has finally, at least in one jurisdiction, decided to use the law at hand to prevent the injury and harm, possible death that can result from the anti-vax movement. Quote, it's been taken seriously more and more, said Mr. LeClaire, who cites a 2011 measles outbreak that struck Quebec, sweeping through the unvaccinated population. It was the largest outbreak anywhere in North or South America since 2002, when the continents were optimistically declared measles-free. Again, we have to remember that we live in a world society, and measles exists in other worlds. So even if we haven't seen it here for a while, it can pop back any time. Now, of course, this vaccinator to be expelled law exists in Ontario, New Brunswick, and Manitoba, but we don't have one here in BC. But maybe we should. Ethan?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess you kind of walk into that fine line of, you know, at what point do we bar you from the public for not taking certain procedures to protect your health? But again, we're talking about turning people into walking biohazards. So I'm kind of on the side that, yes, this is a violation of your personal autonomy, but you know what? I'm kind of okay with that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Of course, you know, what makes the anti-vax movement such a whack-a-mole is there's no real sort of central point. There's no head to be chopped off. I mean, even the complete takedown and discrediting of Wakefield, the father of the current anti-vax crazies, hasn't deadened the movement at all. In a 2011 survey commissioned by the Public Health Agency of Canada, examining the barriers to immunization, the top reason parents cited for not vaccinating their children is that vaccines are not necessary. And in a very distant second place came concerns about the vaccine safely. And although I praise the Ottawa Health Commission for what they did, it was really more of sort of a PR or awareness stunt. Children can return to school after 20 days, vaccinated or not. And for those diehards who don't get their kids vaccinated, the only penalty is that they will be immediately sent home in case of a pandemic. Of course, at that point, it's really kind of too late.
Well, yeah. And the other thing, too, is, I mean, even if they got vaccinated, I mean, some of these vaccines take like a week for them to even become like potent. So, you know, if there is an outbreak, it's probably too late.
You know, and like I say, the fact that they just don't think it needs to be done anymore is Western arrogance to a certain degree. Because although, again, these diseases are not prevalent here anymore, we have people who emigrate to this country from all over the world where they still are, you know, a very dangerous thing. You know, sub-Saharan Africa, you know, parts of Asia, you know, growing even in Europe now, ironically enough, because the anti-vax movement is somewhat stronger there, that it is starting to become a reservoir to spread these diseases internationally.
Well, it's one of those things that, I mean, we're getting to the point where generations of people are growing up, and they don't remember what it was like to live with polio.
No.
Or any really, like, really vehement diseases. And I think it also speaks to the fact that we're just so spoiled. We don't know what we have until it's gone. And the fact that parents are like, oh, well, I don't need to vaccinate my kids, they don't understand that these diseases, they're still here. They're floating around out there. It's just because there's no victim for them to latch onto and infect because everybody's been vaccinated. But it's only a matter of time before it finds one or two people, and boom, now we have polio again.
You know, and sadly, it's probably going to be a pandemic of that sort of note. Well, pandemic's probably overuse of the word, but you know what I mean.
Well, the really scary thing is, and I don't know if you've read some, like, Paul Offit's book and others, but they talk about doctors, they'll get in patients, like panicked parents with their kids, and their kids are, they can't breathe, they're having convulsions, and they don't know what they're doing because they've never seen one of these diseases before. Mm-hmm. And they're like, they're trying all different things and they can't figure it out, and then some old doctor will go, this sort of looks like measles or something. And they'll have to, like, fly the kid to, you know, the nearest major hospital. And, you know, in most cases, they figure it out too late. I mean, it's usually tragic. So, I mean, you know, we're running a lot of risks here. And I don't think people realize just how tragic this story will end.
You know, and it runs in somewhat stark contrast because in some parts of the world, people are willing to risk their lives for vaccination. I don't know if you heard recently, but a polio nurse was shot to death in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Right? You know, because she was trying to go out there, and because of what the Americans did with bin Laden, polio vaccination has a very sinister connotation now with American drone attacks and death squads. But, I mean, to be in these countries and to do this vaccination movement, you know, is risking your life. But they know what the penalty is. They see kids suffering, dying, getting the complications wrong. I mean, that's another thing that a lot of people don't realize is sometimes it's not the disease even in itself that is the problem, but complications that arise out of the disease that can be it. So measles itself, you might say, well, that's not a huge risk. But in some cases, you can get things like brain damage or neural damage, and that is much more serious.
Oh, yeah. A lot of these diseases will complicate other diseases that are floating around out there. Let's take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker. I'll be back with more after this.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
When I was a kid, I didn't have much, but I knew Father's Day was coming up. And I wanted to get my dad something that I could afford, but that would also show how much I cared. So what I did is I got him a t-shirt. It said, World's Greatest Dad, Semi-Finalist.
Just for Laughs presents Anthony Jeselnik, star of Comedy Network's Jeselnik Offensive, at the Vogue Theater, Thursday, June 6. Tickets on sale now at VogueTheater.com or call 604-569-1144.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR.
So now we have the anti-democracy section of the anti-show.
Which is turning
to me. Yes. Last week, the long investigation into robocalls in six ridings finally reached a conclusion. Judge Richard Mosley ruled that the robocalls happened not only in the six ridings that are mentioned in the civil suit that he was ruling on, but across the country. He said that these were not irregularities or pranks, but their intent was voter suppression, which constituted election fraud. It was election fraud. Period. He then went on to say that the fraud occurred through the use, by persons or persons unknown, of the Conservative Party's data bank. He then stated that there's no evidence that the Conservative Party knew or allowed that these parties had access to their database. The judge then decided not to overturn the election results in those ridings, nor did he find the Conservative Party or its candidates or its suppliers were directly involved in, quote, a campaign to mislead the voters. What? It was fraud. He said it was fraud. In Guelph, a campaign worker for the Conservative candidate, Michael Sonia, has actually been charged for preventing or trying to prevent a voter from receiving a ballot via the robocalls. I can understand that you may not want to, that he may not have been able to convict a conservative. They may honestly have been hacked by a supporter. But that's not the point. An election was won by fraud. Regardless of whether the victor was the perpetrator or not, the confidence of the people in Canada's electoral system has been damaged. There should be a new election, at least a by-election. You don't have to ban any of the candidates. None of them have been charged yet with any crime. But whether I rob a bank or not, possession of the ill-gotten gains is still wrong. The judge even stated that the calls struck at the integrity of the electoral process. Quote, from this form of voter suppression was, until the 41st general election, largely unknown in this election. Quote, the evidence points to a concentrated campaign by persons who had access to the voter information maintained by the Conservative Party of Canada. And yet, he didn't overturn the results and call for by-elections. Canada is not some kind of banana republic where these things kind of happen. Not even in the U.S., think Ohio or Florida, has this overt fraud even been attempted. We talked in last week's show about the very low voter turnout being one of the causes of the upset victory in the BC elections. When election fraud occurs and the response from the judiciary is sort of, yeah, but what you gonna do? One can be maybe a bit more sympathetic to those who say, you know, their vote doesn't matter, the system is rigged, nothing's going to change. Any thoughts, Ethan?
Well, I mean, you would think that this would open the door for a lot of lawsuits and criminal charges that could, in theory, reopen the case. So, I mean, you could have, I don't know, someone sue them and force the Supreme Court to overturn the election results.
Well, I don't know if they're going to appeal this decision. That was a bit hazy because this is a civil case.
Mm.
And so I don't know if you can appeal higher in a civil case. In a criminal case, you can go up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But civil cases are slightly different.
Well, election fraud is a crime, is it not?
Well, yes, but who did it?
Right.
I mean, this seems to be a lot of what he was saying. It's like, you know, this was election fraud. We know it happened. Just like, you know, there's a dead body. We know someone was shot and killed. But then he seems to say, well, we have no idea who did it, even though the gun has the Conservative Party logo on it, the bullet has a Conservative Party logo on it, there are footsteps that have the Conservative Party logo on it. but we don't know who did. And to be fair, I mean, when you try for election fraud, you actually have to have somebody to charge. And actually, that may be hard to maintain. He does mention in his report that great efforts were maintained to cover the tracks of whoever did this, which part of me kind of goes, well, duh, of course, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's sort of one dimension to this scandal. That in any other country, of course, would probably have led to the imminent collapse of the ruling party, but not here. Another thing the judge did point out is the complete lack of cooperation of the Conservative Party, who from the onset of this investigation stated that it was a non-issue, a blip. This points, in a very guilt-ridden way, to another aspect of the investigation. It seems the Conservative Party was not going to help. That it's as if in Harperland, it's not the democratic process that counts, but the win. They won, so who cares whether it was fraud or not? And now, true to the form of the Conservative Party, conservatives are looking at this as sort of a vindication of all their undertakings. You know, where is the deterrent for the next election? For all parties, right? Where's the lesson to be learned here? The judge did point out in what only seems to be sort of a bipolar decision. I mean, it's really hard reading this because in some senses he's very much anti and the other he's sort of washing under the carpet. On one hand, there was election fraud that was not done by the Conservatives. On the other hand, they definitely acted like they did it. He states, the Conservatives behave as though they had something to hide. The party did not act as though its primary goal was the protection and upholding of the integrity of the election process. He points out that, and again, I quote here, the Conservative Party of Canada made little effort to assist with the investigation, even at the onset, despite early requests. You would think that if their precious database was hacked or improperly used, they'd want justice, but they seem to be quite okay with what happened. Now, I don't know, you know, this before, but apparently the Conservative campaign knew the day of the election that these fraudulent calls were going out, but said nothing. The judge stated again, I note that the Council for the Conservatives was informed while the election was taking place that the calls about polling station changes were improper. And while it begrudgingly concedes during oral argument that what occurred was absolutely outrageous, the records indicate that the stance taken by the respondents' MPs from the outset was to block all proceedings by any means. They knew and they did nothing about it. Even if they were not directly the perpetrators of the fraud, by this admission, they definitely seem to be aiding and abetting. So not only do we have election fraud, but we also have a party that was stonewalling the investigation into the fraud. Now, I should point out that this is not a criminal case, i.e. beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's a civil court, which is sort of preponderance of the evidence. How did the judge not rule completely against the Conservative Party or the candidates? So I want your thoughts, Ethan. I know at times I can get a bit partisan at times, but talk me down for this. But we have an official judge certifying a fraudulent election. We have a party that benefited from said fraud that consequently or coincidentally refuses to cooperate with the investigation into said fraud. Does this or does this not smell a complete political shite?
Well, I mean, if you're putting yourself in the position of the judge, there still is no direct evidence that there was a perpetrator in the Conservative Party. All we have is circumstantial evidence. So I can understand their position to a certain extent. They literally can't do anything else about this until there's a criminal investigation.
Well, you know what's even funnier? The Conservatives, in their weak response to this, the government officially, said that they were going to enact some new laws to help cut down on this sort of activity. And they were supposed to introduce this on last Wednesday, but at the last minute they sort of pulled it because they said, oh, well, we need to do something to it to begin with, but they didn't quite say what. Almost as if it was like, as a placation to the judge that, hey, yes, we're going to do some things. And then they say, ah, no, we're not. You know, I mean, one of the things which is really odd, if you think about it, but it's not a crime for me to phone up and say, hey, I'm an official from Elections Canada and X, Y, and Z. That's not a crime. And I think that's part of, as you say, part of the judge's sort of bipolar is on the one hand, he's sitting there saying, this smells really, really bad. But technically, there's not much I can do about it because the way our election laws are written, there's no thing that I can charge somebody with. Okay, now I kind of promised that I wouldn't venture into the Senate scandal, but alas, it seems Harper has provided an excellent reason too. Skeptics don't like the subversion of democracy. Now, a quick rundown about what this Senate scandal is. There are four senators who claim living allowances for the provincial homes, which they were not entitled to. Although they argued that the Senate rules are hard to interpret, the fact that 101 senators seem to figure them out okay kind of makes this seem more of an excuse than a reason. One is also facing felony charges for domestic violence, which is not a good thing. Two of the four, conservative Pamela Wallen and Patrick Duffy, are also accused of claiming Senate expenses that really were election campaign expenses, sort of double dipping. So far, you know, it's just sort of your regular scandal, something we would probably have left to a more political pundit type show. But then this happened. Duffy offered to pay back the overcharge he billed the Senate to the tune of $90,000. It turns out Duffy's not that kind of rich after all, and he couldn't actually lay his hands on 90 large. So in walks Nigel Wright, head of the PMO, or Harper's right-hand man, who cut Duffy a personal check for $90,000. Then it comes out that in return for the reimbursement of the money, the Senate committee would go easy on Duffy's expense audit. Harsh lines were removed, and who knows what else was not done. When this first came to light, Harper said there was nothing wrong was done. Then in a couple of days, apparently he was upset, very upset, at what had happened and accepted the resignation of Wright. On the one hand, this may seem just like an old boys network run awry, or maybe Duffy knows something, did something, claimed something that would have turned this into a greater embarrassment for the Conservative Party or Mr. Harper. Or maybe Wright thought that a little quick cash, I mean, he is one of the one percenters after all, would win him favors later on. Who knows? Regardless of whether something nefarious occurred or not, yet again, there is this strong appearance of wrongdoing, and that in itself is a cause for action. One of the important things about a democracy to work is it must appear to be above and beyond sort of reproach. And if you get these things happening with the complacency of the government, it damages the brand of democracy. It weakens people's trust in the government. So what is known is Mr. Clean, Harper, seems to admit in the midst of a, if I may quote the Trailer Park Boys here, in the middle of a shitstorm. Harper preached transparency and accountability while in opposition. Now that he has become Emperor of Canada, he seems to act in the exact opposite way as his previous speech. Perhaps the most damning thing to come out of the robocall investigation is, as I already mentioned, how the Conservative Party refused, delayed, and were generally uncooperative with the investigation. The judge stated that, despite the obvious public interest at getting to the bottom of the allegations, the Conservative Party made little effort to assist in the investigation at the onset despite early requests. That needs to be repeated. You know, they did not cooperate with the investigation. It is almost a habit of the Conservative Party to turn everything into a partisan battle. Who cares if the election fraud strikes at the very heart of democracy in the land? Who cares if a crime was committed? All they seem to worry about is how many political points can be scored. Again, the judge. These proceedings have had a partisan overtone from the onset. It seems to me that the applicants, in this case it's the Council of Canadians who have raised their complaint against the robocalls, the applicants sought to achieve and uphold the high ground of promoting the integrity of the electoral system, while the respondents, i.e. Conservative MPs, engaged in trench warfare in an effort to prevent this case from coming to be heard on its merits. Quote, despite the obvious public interest in getting to the bottom of the allegations, the Conservative Party of Canada made little effort to assist in the investigation. Sorry, it stuns me. The record indicates that the stance taken by the respondents, again, the Conservatives, from the outset was to block the proceedings by every means possible. I mean, wow, the Conservatives are chalking this up as a vindication. And that they get to keep their seats. But what the judge has said, if you read the whole judgment, is, well, essentially he says is that they did it. You know, I haven't been presented with enough evidence to rule that way, but I mean, it sure really smells like they did it. One last note. I mentioned that the Conservative campaign worker was charged. He seems to feel that the parties have sort of thrown him under the bus and may have... And so maybe when his court case comes up, there may be some interesting things to come out. But in a Twitter conversation, Michael Sonia, the one who's been accused of the voter fraud, was responding to a loyal conservative tweeter, hashtag legacy, thusly, legacy. Conservative candidates were vindicated. Only media want to keep it alive. Sona, you clearly didn't read the judge's decision. Legacy, you clearly read the decision with pink-colored glasses. I'm not sure why pink, but... MPs were vindicated and left in office. Sona, decision said fraud happened in many writings. CPC, Conservative Party of Canada's, database used. The Conservatives tried to derail investigation. Vindication? Huh? Legacy, did you have a role in these allegations? Sona, no. And not an allegation, was a legal finding in a federal court of justice. Ethan, I'm speechless.
Yeah, well, it's funny because previous Canadian governments have been derailed by less of a scandal. So you just have to wonder what our next federal election is going to be. I mean, it just kind of bugs me because I hate being envious of the American political system, but at least they have ways of dealing with this kind of stuff. You know, it's like, short of me, like, you know, going to the Governor General's house and banging on his door and saying, please dissolve Parliament, there's nothing you can do about this.
No.
I mean, it's ludicrous. What kind of democracy is this? Why did they do this? Why can't they be rational and come up with a democracy that, like, has checks and balances?
Well, you know, that's one of the other weird things, because, again, absence of checks and balances. With this check that was cut to Duffy, right? And a lot of people saying, well, what the heck is going on with this? I mean, not only people like you and me, but I mean, hardcore conservatives are saying, hey, what the hell is going on here? The only one who has the authority to call an investigation is Harper.
Yeah.
So really, foxes guarding chicken coop sort of thing, right? It's so, and the thing that really, really gets to me, and he probably is going to win again. I mean, I hope he doesn't. Oh, I really hope he doesn't, right? But do you remember the roll-up to the last election? He was convicted. He was convicted of the Conservatives were convicted of they lied to the Senate, right? Mm. Lied to the House of Parliament, right? I forget the term. And they had all sorts of scandals, not quite as bad as this, maybe, but kind of like this. And people just sort of said, "Eh, I'm going to vote for him anyway because minorities are bad or something." Mm. Well, you got a majority now, and now literally there is nothing we can do. I mean, at least if this was a minority government, you, Ethan, we would have something we could do. We could phone up Montclair or Trudeau or whatever and say, hey, guys, we need to change what's going on.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I haven't been keeping track of sort of the political strategies that have been happening. But, I mean, historically speaking, this government has followed sort of the trend. You start as the opposition. You go to a minority government. You get a majority. If the trend goes on, they'll probably win, but with a minority, and then probably lose the next election. I mean, it's not the answer we want to hear, but people tend to vote this way. They vote in sort of predictable patterns.
You know, and the funny thing is, and again, this is, I guess, an irony, is if this had happened to Montclair or Trudeau or some other politician, right, Paul Martin or whatever, right, it would be bad. But what makes it even worse is the level of hypocrisy that comes out of this. Because, again, one of the things that Harper claimed that his party would do when they took office was to clean up the government, to be very transparent, to make sure that the shenanigans like the sponsorship scandal couldn't happen on his watch. And they have. And maybe even worse than that, because, again, some of these are much more dubious.
Well, I mean, yeah, he presented himself as the new sheriff in town.
Yeah.
And if anything, he's proven to be the old sheriff in town. I mean, there's nothing new about it. And the bad thing about that is that people are going to look at this and go, oh, well, you know, what's the point? It's all this. Every party is the same. They're all corrupt. They're all scoundrels. You know, why should I waste my time voting? And they don't understand the nuance of the other things that the Conservatives are doing that are causing problems, or that any political party does that cause problems. I mean, you know, you look at the Liberals back with Chrétien when they were winning like 98% of the seats. That wasn't a good thing either. You know, like you give these kind of mandates to govern, And then you allow sort of the silliest little things to happen, and those things add up, and that's where all the problems happen.
You know, and to add to the irony of this is that, you know, I mean, he has a majority, right? And he came on as Mr. Clean, and I'm going to clean up government. And then he stated when he first got in there, well, I was voted on a mandate to get rid of the gun registry, and I was voted to get rid of the weed board. Poof, those were gone. But he hasn't been able to introduce anything on electoral reform. He hasn't been able to do anything even on Senate reform,
yeah.
Right? Which, again, were his core issues. There have been a number of times where laws that were meant to deal with this sort of issue have been left on the book until the session ends. I can't think of any good reason why he wouldn't, other than it's great to proclaim these sort of rules when you're in opposition. But once you have the reins, you don't like the fact that there might be a cop around to say, slow down, boy.
Yeah. It's definitely it's a smelly situation, to use your words.
Well, yes, more than smelly.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I don't know really how much, if there's much more we can really say about this, and maybe we should just cut it early. But it just strikes me as very, very sad.
I think that one thing that I can at least put out there, maybe some people find this information useful or not, but get involved with the democratic process. I mean, I don't necessarily mean like become a politician or volunteer with a political group, but just get involved with the political process. Volunteer with BC Elections or Elections Canada, work as a poll clerk, whatever. See if there's any like groups out there that are working on things like bringing out voters, get people who rent buses and drive seniors out to vote. See if you can find something to do like that to get involved with, because that does make a difference. And, you know, if you become part of that frontline supporter of democracy, that will have a big impact. And you can overshadow the crap that happens in sort of the high pearl towers of politics.
Well, you know, and that leads into another thing. I mean, one of the things that came out about the BC election is that the Liberals won the majority with only 21% of the popular vote, so to speak, right? I mean, not the 21% of people who voted, but all the people who could have voted, only really they got 21%. And that leads into the idea that, I mean, I was listening to a show the other day, and someone might correct me on this, that only less than 1% of Canadians are actually members of political parties. I mean, everyone says they are. And those are the people who elect the candidates. So if you sit there and say, well, there are no good candidates, well, that's where you can go out and you can become a member of your party of choice, be it right, left, center, or other, mm-hmm. right? And take part in trying to mold that particular the vote to the way you want to. I mean,
they do actually listen to people. It's surprising how much they do. It's just there's not a lot of different voices in that process.
Well, you get a lot of the echo chamber. I mean, you know, it's one of the sad things. I mean, one of the reasons why you don't get as much labor support in the NDP is because a lot of people are working two or three jobs. So the people who show up are much more sort of centrist, which is why that party has moved to the center. And you get the same thing for each other party. They tend to shift in one particular direction because you got hardly anyone participating. Those people who are participating do tend to have very focused agendas, and not always agendas that represent the majority, because by definition, it's a minority of a minority of a minority.
Yeah.
So getting out and being involved is one very, very positive way to make the world a better place. And just a last note, because some people will sit there and say, well, we should abolish the Senate, which may or may not be a good idea. But I heard that the NDP came out last week saying, you know, that's the real issue. We need to get rid of the Senate. That's the only problem. One, no, it's not the Senate. That's really the issue. The issue is sort of the fraud and shenanigans going on there. But, I mean, we can't even get Quebec to sign the Constitution. To abolish one of the Houses of Parliament is a pretty major change to the Constitution that Ontario and Quebec definitely are not going to want to go on to, and they have to go on to it for it to happen. So even though you might think, you know, getting rid of the Senate would be a good thing, ain't going to happen.
No.
Senate reform, quite possible. In fact, there are two, two questions that have been presented to the Supreme Court by Harper, finally, after how many years he's been in power, asking, A, you know, how much power does the House of Commons have over the Senate with regards to Senate reform, and can the House of Commons actually abolish the Senate? Which, I mean, the obvious answer is no, it can't, but But, you know, the response to this particular issue is you need to be focused on what the real problem is. And the real problem is corruption and disinvolvement of people.
Mm.
The more sunshine you throw onto these particular festering sores, the sooner they dry up and disappear.
Absolutely. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights. I have two highlights this week. The first one is Life, Liberty, and the Right to Die, which is CFI Vancouver's upcoming lecture happening on Friday, May 31st at 7 p.m., located in room 1700 of SFU Harbor Center. Should be really interesting, actually, discussing sort of the legal ramifications of dying with dignity, and it's being presented by Rebecca Code. My next highlight is actually a book that I've been reading, and I mentioned this, I think, last week. It's Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking by Dan Dennett. About halfway through it, it is really interesting, and it's not one of those sort of, you know, really thick philosophical texts that take, you know, 2 hours to get through the first sentence. It's actually very readable, entertaining, it's funny, and it's got a lot of great advice for how to think your way through problems.
I like those thick, dense books that, you know, every word takes you an hour to figure out, what does he mean by this?
Well, I suppose if you really wanted to question it, you could. But, I mean, it is actually quite enjoyable. Again, that's Intuition Pumps. You can find it in your local bookstore at the library.
I, this week, have a whole heck load of things to bring up. Actually, I got two sort of standard highlights and two things I thought would be interesting to bring up as a more of a different one. So, first of all, I thought you were going to mention this one, Ethan, but so I will. June 2nd is Slut Walk Vancouver.
Mm, yes.
Where they're going out fighting sexism in the world. And where is the rally happening?
I think it's at the Art Gallery.
I'm pretty sure it's at the Art Gallery. We'll have a link on our webpage about it. As I say, I thought you were going to cover this one, so I hadn't looked into it. But everyone needs to know about Slut Watch because, you know, we need to stand together to wipe out, you know, the badness in our society. And as a skeptical movement, this whole idea of anti-feminist sort of talk, misogyny and all that, is very prevalent to us. And showing our support, going out there, not only showing our support, but going out and becoming aware and more in tune with what the real issues are, is probably a good thing.
Absolutely.
The other event that I'm going to mention is the Canadian Polyamory Advocacy Association is presenting PolyCon, Claiming Our Right to Love. Polyamory, i.e. being married to more than one person, was confirmed legal in Canada in 2011 with BC Supreme Court reference question, so it's legal. Apparently they're having a convention where they're going to go on and, I don't know, get more wives or husbands. You know, it could be an interesting thing. I thought it was kind of weird. Why not? Apparently it's being held at the UBC Robson Center, starting this Friday at 31st at 7 p.m. and it ends Sunday, June 2nd. Obviously, they're going to have talks about the legality, about some of the difficulties of living in a polyandry sort of situation, and they have a dinner. Now, to be fair, the cost is vary, and it's actually most of it's all been sold out, which I thought was really kind of interesting. But I guess when you're buying for a family and you've got, you know, you got to buy one for the husband, one for the wife, one for the wife, one for the wife, and one for the husband, I guess tickets can be sucked up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So the other two things I want to bring up, which is sort of different from our normal sort of skeptic highlights, is apparently online retailer Altos is recalling a bunch of belts. Do you know why, Ethan?
No, why?
They're radioactive.
Oh, that would do it.
The belts are made from leather and covered with metal studs, but they've been shown to have cobalt 60 in them. Apparently somewhere like 50 were bought in 50 countries. It's an online sale, so it's easy to track them down. But apparently this kind of thing is not that uncommon. In India and the Far East, large consumers of scrap metal go there. And during the refining process, these metals, along with orphaned radioactive sources, are sometimes accidentally melted together and turned into things like studs on belts. So if you want to check out something kind of interesting, one, check your wardrobe with a Geiger counter. Who knows? Mm. You might have something radioactive. A better way, just turn out the lights and see if it glows.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to bring up, we were going to mention earlier in the show, but I thought it was worth mentioning, is the on-again, off-again love-hate of atheists by the Catholic Church. A lot of atheists were quite uplifted when the Pope said that atheists can be good people too, even though they don't believe. And then about 2 or 3 days later, a high official in the Catholic Church said, "But you're still going to hell." So, you know, check that out. Just see what was going on. It's kind of an interesting topic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole infallibility thing is kind of going out of style.
Yeah, it is. Well, but now he's only half infallible because there are two popes, remember? So
that's true.
So maybe every second word is...
They split it.
Yeah.
He gets it on the first week. He gets it on the second week.
Could be.
Anyway, we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. So this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion.